Welcome to Stealing from Wizards, Volume 1, Pickpocketing, by R.A. Consul, read by the author. Chapter 16, The Locket. Once safely back in the lodge, with tears dried and breathing back to normal, Crow asked Meredith about something that hadn't quite made sense in their shouting match.
Meredith, what did you mean when you said that I was one of you?
You're an orphan, right? Like me and Bella.
She looked at Crow with a sad sort of empathy.
Oh, no, I'm not, Crow replied.
What? I thought you lost your parents. You don't even know your last name.
I don't have parents, Crow informed her.
What?
She shook her head and laughed at Crow, as though he had just claimed to be a very talkative teapot.
You're a funny kid. Of course you do. Everyone's got parents, even if you don't know who they are. It doesn't matter, though. You're alone, like us. We don't have anyone looking out for us, so we look out for each other. Or, we're supposed to.
Meredith sighed.
Bella forgets that sometimes. She's got a good heart when she remembers to use it. She just tries too hard to prove that she's as good as the kids with rich parents.
Why is she at Summerhill, then? Demanded Charlie, inserting herself into their conversation. Shouldn't she be at the lodge with us weirdos?
She probably wishes she was, but she'd never say it out loud. She has the terrible luck of having a fancy family name with none of the fancy family that usually comes with it. The summer court sponsors her just because of her heritage, so she's stuck in that stuffy residence with the rich kids.
She smiled and ruffled her junior's hair.
Now, get to bed, you two. We'll work on that spell of yours another day.
The next day was Solstice Eve. Meredith refused on moral grounds to do any work at all, and instead forced as many students as she could outside for a snowball fight in the winter quarter. She challenged a match of Autumn Lodge versus everyone, which went very well at first. Witches and wizards, broadly speaking, never learn how to throw a ball properly. Athletics are thought to be for mundane folk who don't have better ways of getting things done. The couple of practice lacrosse players were the only ones who could really hit anyone, and the addition of Meredith to the lodger's side provided an unfair advantage until the magic came out. Soon, the seven lodgers were sorely outmatched by a battery of snow cannons and fortified walls of ice conjured by the couple of Wertheim residents, who had more experience with ice and snow than anyone. The battle raged on till late in the afternoon, when the sun sank too low to see clearly and everyone was too exhausted and caked in snow to continue. They all went back to Autumn Lodge for hot apple cocoa soda and gingerbread. Bella was notably missing from the battle. Charlie kept Crew and Meredith up as late as possible, telling ghost stories. She was a very good storyteller, though some of her haunting climaxes were diminished by the fact that Crew had lived with an actual ghost. Far too late at night, Crow climbed, exhausted and happy, into bed and went to sleep. He woke earlier than he would have liked because of Charlie's excited laughter echoing up from the lounge. He stretched, yawned, clambered out of bed, and nearly broke his neck, tripping on a pile of junk and paper someone had left at the foot of his bed. He cursed and blearily made his way out to see what Charlie was so excited about. "Presents!" she shouted. She was wearing an oversized red sock on her head and grinning furiously.
Happy solstice! Get your presents so we can open them!
I don't get presents, Crow yawned.
But I like to watch you open yours.
Charlie looked affronted.
You better get presents! I got you one!
You did? Crow asked in shock.
What is it?
I can't tell you! You have to open it! Don't you know how this works?
No, Crow admitted. I've never gotten a solstice present before.
Well, go and get them, and I'll show you!
She shooed him out back to his dorm. Crow returned to his room, and as he stepped inside, his jaw fell open. The pile of trash he'd tripped over wasn't trash at all. It was a pile of packages. A pile. Some were neatly wrapped in shimmering multicolored paper with bows, others roughly wrapped in brown paper and tied with twine for the post. He had to use his bed sheet as a sack to get them all back to the common room in one trip. By the time he got back, Meredith was there, too, groggily sorting through her pile of packages.
"What's going on?" Crow stuttered.
"Yule!"
Charlie exclaimed as though that explained everything.
"But where did they all come from?"
That's what the cards are for. They tell you who sent them, she explained patiently.
She went on to describe the elaborate ritual for opening presents. They first had to be appreciated for their aesthetic qualities. One had to admire the paper and the bow and the effort that was put into wrapping them. Then each needed to be gently shaken so that one could guess their contents. Only then could they be opened. They all had one matching package. A small square white box with a very neat red bow and a card that read L.M., written on it in impeccable handwriting.
That's from McCutcheon. Same every year, said Meredith. Go on, pull the bow.
Corot pulled the red bow, and the box started to transform. It bloomed like a flower, each of the petals becoming thick and fully transforming into a beautifully arranged collection of lollipops. A rainbow of saltwater taffy and candied apples, with a small fleet of licorice witches flying in circles around it.
She's just showing off, said Meredith, opening her own and picking out a taffy to chew on. Word to the wise, the licorice witches are vile, but McCutcheon loves them. I think she gives them to us, so we'll share them with her.
They started opening presents in turn. Marie and Charlie had both made him cards. From the looks of them, they had done them together. They were on the same thick paper and used the same red ink. But that is where the similarities stopped. The card from Marie read Joyeux Noël on the front, in neat and careful script, and had a simple message about peace and joy on Christmas inside. Charlie's writing was as uneven and lopsided as she was. The front of the card just said Solstice! And the inside was an almost illegible mess of writing that started with her being sad to leave him behind and by the end talking about feeding cookies to a hydra. Arthur had sent Kuro and Charlie actual presents, which must have been delivered by the Luton post in the night. Kuro's included a cream that would cause beards and mustaches to grow. He had given Charlie a brush that changed the user's hairstyle at random. She was distracted for the next 15 minutes, trying different hairstyles, all of them shocking and terrible. Kuro was confused by the gift, especially the card which said, "You might find this useful." Kuro wondered if it was a joke, but he hadn't seen any sign that Arthur had a sense of humor. He couldn't actually imagine the stoic and shy boy laughing. Kuro added Arthur's card to the other two and started to feel very guilty.
"I didn't get you anything."
"Of course you didn't," Charlie replied while admiring her latest hairstyle, a large pompadour in the shape of a sailing ship. "That's not the point anyway."
Kuro tried to hide his tears by digging out another box, a small and simply wrapped package. The card said it was from Sabine LSR. Meredith piped up again, though her jaw was mostly glued closed by toffee.
"That'll be a book," she mumbled.
Kuro opened it, and it was indeed a book.
"Balthazar Said and the Mystery of the She Queen."
"How did you know?" he asked.
"Oh, Sabine's pretty predictable,"
she replied, waving a new copy of Beyond the Veil, Adventures in the Blandlands.
Do you know him? I mean, her?" asked Kuro, confounded.
"Oh, of course. She's my caseworker. Has been for years. She's great. Tries really hard. Tough to get me adopted, though, when I'm bigger than most of the dads."
Kuro had a sudden sinking feeling that he had been very mistaken in his suspicions of Miss Elazar. He doubted that Dubois would have been secretly working with all the orphan children at Avalon for the past several years. He was left with a haunting feeling that she might actually be the compassionate person she pretended to be. He tried to banish that idea by convincing himself that she was at least reporting to Dubois, and that the strange and nonsensical answers he'd been giving her were not completely without cause. Kuro had another mysterious package. It was soft and pliable, which Charlie had taught him meant clothes. The card was unsigned, but had a note in sloppy scrawl. "Kuro, I hope you are finding a home at Avalon. School can be pretty heavy, but this might ease your burden." That didn't make any sense at all, but he opened the package regardless. Inside was a familiar brown leather book bag with a brass letter K on the buckle. It was definitely the one he had picked up in the Lost and Found, but someone had polished the leather and fixed the worn stitching. He stared into the cavernous interior of the sack in disbelief. Inside was a large, dimly lit space filled with shelves and drawers, all cleaned and freshly varnished. He found that the mouth of the enchanted satchel could stretch quite wide, so he laid the bag down and climbed inside. He checked through the various drawers, finding them all empty, and found a place on a shelf to store his new book. He crawled back out of the bag to find Meredith and Charlie staring open-mouthed at him. The three of them played with the mysterious bag for a while. They worked to see what the largest thing they could put inside was. They managed to put a large potted plant and a wooden stool, but the armchair got stuck and they had a hard time retrieving it. Meredith had to haul on the chair leg she could reach while the other two children pulled the bag in the other direction. Meredith was very impressed with it and said she thought those kinds of enchantments were really expensive.
"Who sent it?" she wondered.
"I think it's from Ms. Wong in The Lost and Found," said Kuro. "I can't believe she fixed it up and sent it to me."
Kuro's last package was nearly lost amidst the pile of torn wrappings. It was an uneven mess of a package, hastily wrapped in brown paper. A simple note on lined paper said only, "I'm sorry." He tore it open to find his shoes, full of leaves and covered in dirt, but otherwise fine. Had Bella really had them the whole time? Had she taken them as further revenge?
"Look, Charlie, look! She gave them back!"
Charlie didn't respond. She was sitting very still and quiet, clutching something tight to her chest. This seemed very wrong to Kuro. Charlie never sat quietly. He didn't think her capable. Charlie was unflappably passionate. She could be ecstatic, furious, devastated, exuberant, but never subdued, never quiet.
"Charlie, what's wrong?"
"What?"
she said in a sad, soft voice.
It's nothing. I just..."
She pushed the card over to Kuro. "My dearest Charlotte, I'm sorry you couldn't make it home for the holiday. I hope you are with friends there. We're all fine here, despite the snow. You should always be with family for the solstice, so I thought I should finally pass this along to you. If you can't be close to us, at least you can have us close to you. It was your mother's. She would want you to have it. Keep it close to your heart, as you are always in ours. Merry Solstice. Love, Dad."
"It's my mother's locket," said Charlie, wiping a tear from her eye. She struggled to open the little silver pendant. "It has pictures inside of my mom and dad from before I was born. Have I ever told you about my mom?"
Kuro shook his head.
"Oh, Dad says she was a great witch, an enchantress, and a Valkyrie before that. I didn't know her much, though. She disappeared when I was too small to remember. Nobody knew where, just vanished one day without a trace. She came back one day when I was 5. She had been kidnapped by a warlock. The hounds had finally tracked her down and freed her. For 2 months, it was like she'd never been gone, like I had a whole family. She was really smart and pretty and nice, and then..."
She trailed off, partly because she was struggling to keep her voice steady, and partly out of frustration at being unable to open the locket.
"You have small hands. Can you get this open?"
she asked, passing it to Kuro. Kuro took the circular pendant from Charlie. It was silver with an elven world tree pattern on it. He popped it open with ease and caught a glimpse of the faces within before he could hand it back. Kuro's heart stopped at the sight of Charlie's mother. He knew her. She was younger and looked happier and healthier than he remembered, but that young witch in the picture haunted his nightmares.
"What was her name?"
he asked with what little breath he could muster.
"Helena," replied Charlie. "It's a pretty name."
"Helena Vigdis," muttered Kuro in horror. It was her. Without a doubt, it was the young woman who had been his tutor and caregiver for the first years of his life. It made a sick sort of sense, given how Phineas thought. He needed someone to raise a young child, so he just found someone that was already doing it. No need for training or uncertainty about qualifications. It was deeply, sickly rational. Of all the cruelties that Kuro had suffered, of all the beatings and hardships he'd gone through, the feeling in his heart at that moment was far worse than any of them. Kuro had always feared his master, but he had never hated him. Now Kuro understood what it meant to truly hate someone, what they meant when they talked about evil. He hadn't just murdered a woman. He had torn apart a family, Charlie's family, and Kuro had just stood by and watched it happen.
"How do you know her last name?"
asked Charlie innocently. It was too much. Kuro ran. He dropped everything and ran from the lodge. He flew through the forest as fast as his feet could carry him, not even looking where he was going.
Thank you for listening to Stealing from Wizards. If you liked our show, please consider rating or reviewing on iTunes. If you want to support this podcast or just can't wait for the next chapter, the full book is available on Amazon, Kobo, and Indigo. Our theme music was written by Camille Saint-Saëns, transcribed by Franz Liszt, performed by Rebecca Verdun, and used with permission. This episode was produced by Jim Tigwell.